In today's lecture, we're discussing the period that I'm referring to as the Christian Empire, the early period. We've been dividing our study through church history into these categories so far. And again, I want to stress, these categories are somewhat artificial. There's no hard and fast markers. It's just a general outline for sort of categorizing periods in church history. But what we've looked at so far is we've taken a look at the period that we call the Apostolic Church. That's 33 to approximately 180. Then the early church, AD 100 to perhaps about 312. 312 marks the conversion of Constantine. Then we're talking about this very long period of what we call the Christian Empire from 312 to 1500. And we've divided that very long period into the first period or the first era of that to about the year 1000, and then the second era from about 1000 to about the year 1500. So this is kind of the broad parameters that we're taking a look at. And what we want to speak about in this lecture is daily life in the West. Now, I want to stretch that because really most of the time, at least in the circles that I'm familiar with, when you're studying church history, the focus is on the West. Now, of course, you can take classes and there's a lot of fruitful study of focusing on church history or Christian history in the East. And by the East, we don't mean, you know, as far as China and India and such as that. We're really talking about what was the Eastern part of the Roman Empire, those faiths that developed into what today we call the Orthodox communions. But that's the East. What we're mainly talking about is the West. So daily life in the West, the early Christian Empire period, we're going to be talking about some features of that, and then just a few sort of, assorted things we'll talk about towards the end. So if I were to describe what daily life was in the West in this period that we call the early Christian Empire period, again, somewhere from about the conversion of Constantine to about the year 1000, I would say one thing to consider is that life was hard. It was harder than before the fall of the Roman Empire. Now, again, we're talking about the fall of the Roman Empire in the mid to late 5th century, you know, just to throw out approximately 450, 460. Life was hard after the fall of the Roman Empire, harder, I should say. When the Western Roman Empire collapsed, one contemporary man wrote, he said, "The mother of all the world has been killed." And to a lot of people, that's how it felt. You could say that in these decades, these centuries, there were many more Christians, but there was at least somewhat fewer people. Cities especially were depopulated. What few people there were lived in a formerly great city. They would gather in one portion of the former city, and the rest was given over to wild animals and whatever. The wilderness was frightening like never before. Communities often lived in relative isolation because communication and transportation were often so slow or so bad. At the same time, the reminders of the former glory of Rome and Greece could still be seen. You could see the ruins of roads and aqueducts and bridges. These things fell into disrepair, but they were still there. And you could tell that in many ways, there was a technology at work that was superior to anything that was being done in this period of the early Christian Empire. It must have been something surreal to be surrounded by the ruins of what was in many ways a culture more sophisticated and more advanced as your own. In this early Christian Empire period, if you lived in Europe, in the West during this time, you probably lived on a small farm, and you were a farmer instead of a trader or a merchant. Of course, there were traders and merchants, but many, many more people were farmers. The networks that a society needs to effectively trade were severely set back. So again, of course, there were traders and merchants, just a lot fewer of them because the infrastructure for society had passed away. And as you lived on the farm, you lived your life according to the seasons of the year. You worked almost every moment of the day at planting time and harvest time, but then you did almost nothing through the winter. And life was very hard. An example of this is seen in the death rates for mothers and babies during some of the years of this era. According to some calculations, 20% of women died in childbirth, 5% of babies died in childbirth, and 10% of the surviving babies died in the first year. Those were a lot of people dying just having to do with giving birth and the babies who were born. You were also born into a class of society, and it was just expected that you would stay in that class. You see, medieval society was seen as composed of three complementary classes. Somebody wrote and described it like this: some pray, others fight, and still others work. So that refers to the clergy, to the knights, and to the lay people. And these three groups lived together, and they needed each other. They couldn't survive, I should say, apart from one another. Many medieval churches were owned privately by wealthy laymen. They were owned by monasteries, maybe bishops. The owner might sell or pass the property on as he wished after his death, and the revenues went into his own pocket, and out of those revenues from the church, he would appoint a priest. He would have the priest ordained, and he would pay the priest. Many owners gave the parish priest something of a living, and they were just simply a rector, a pastor, whatever, who received most of the revenues. If you were there in a church, in a village, or a town, your priest was probably not married, but he probably, or oftentimes, had a mistress, what be known as a concubine. You see, even though priests took vows of celibacy, many of them had concubines. And the practice was often open and accepted as long as the priest was faithful to one woman. One writer told about a woman who lived with a very loving priest for as many years and bore him four sons, and three of the four sons became priests. Another feature about medieval Christianity in this early period and then developing on in the later period as well, as we'll see, is you were taught to despise the Jewish people. Since Jews were considered to be responsible for killing Jesus Christ, they were discriminated against. Jews weren't allowed to sell flour or wine or oil or clothing to Christians. In some places, Jews, along with Muslims or heretics or prostitutes, were required to appear in public only if they had a circular patch of yellow felt that would identify them as Jews. Because the church became the most prominent institution of order and organization, Christianity and the institutions of the Christian world were a way to be promoted and advanced. Almost all the opportunity for advancement came through the church and its associated institutions. So in these institutions, of course, Christianity was assumed. It was expected. But oftentimes it was a very superstitious or uneducated Christianity. Feeding into this as well was that literacy and learning sharply declined. You probably lived without access to a Bible if you were an everyday Christian in this period of the early Christian empire. Again, we're talking about the years approximately 312 to the year 1000. In the ancient and medieval worlds, some Christians were able to memorize large portions of Scripture. Eusebius of Caesarea said that once he met a blind Egyptian man who possessed whole books of the Holy Scriptures in his heart. And Christians who did have access to the Bible often focused on the Old Testament. It's a curious thing in biblical studies. Between the 500s and the 900s in Western Europe, the Old Testament was dominant in the consciousness of many Christians. Maybe it was because of the former barbarian Germans and Celts who identified with the Hebrews, who had to conquer rival nations and subdue the promised land. Early medieval clergy were inspired by Old Testament references to incense in worship, to anointings with oil, to tithing, and to strict observance of the Sabbath. There was a focus on the Old Testament. These Christians read the New Testament filtered through their very warlike cultures and the Old Testament imagery. It's almost as if they tend to interpret the Old Testament in light of the New instead of interpreting the New Testament in light of the Old Testament or whatever it was. They sometimes gave more authority or act as if it was a second revelation to be received above the New Testament. Many times it was seen that Jesus was more of a stern judge to whom all the world would answer than he was the loving Savior who laid down his life for the world. There was a lot of emphasis on the scene of judgment in Matthew chapter 25 and the very grand vision of judging all the nations and the world at the end of the age. That separation of the just and the unjust. These things were very big in the mind of the Middle Ages. Now, after the Viking invasions came to an end in the 11th century, Western Europe gradually became settled, more urbanized, more literate, more populated, and more prosperous. Under those conditions, Europe sort of rediscovered the Gospels. And this resulted in a very deep religious change. Some people compare it to the change that the reformers had when they just sort of discovered, so to speak, the Apostle Paul in the 1500s. Now, another thing to understand is that if you were a Christian in the West in this period, approximately between the year AD 312 and the year 1000, then your Christianity was really defined by the Roman Catholic Church. The phenomenon that we know of today is there being many different denominations and many different flavors of Christianity. That would be true if you took a look at the Christian world as a whole. If you took a look at Christianity in the East and Christianity in Africa and Christianity as it extended into different regions. But in the West, in Europe at this time, it was almost exclusively dominated by the Roman Catholic Church. And during this period, the Roman Catholic Church continued to define what Christianity was and to express its authority, having the right to define what Christianity was. So, for example, in the year 600, the use of Latin in prayer and worship was commanded by Pope Gregory I. That's Gregory the Great. In the year 600, prayers were directed to Mary, dead saints, and angels by papal allowance. 709, the practice of kissing the Pope's feet began with Pope Constantine. In the year 786, came the authorization of the veneration of the cross, of images, and of relics. In the year 927, the College of the Cardinals was established. In the year 995, the initiation of the canonization of the dead as saints began to be established. In the year 1000, attendance at Mass was made mandatory for all Christians. And in the year 1090, Peter the Hermit invented the rosary and repetitious praying with beads. So again, the Roman Catholic Church was in some sense the dominant institution of Christianity in the Western Christian world in this period. And under the efforts of the Roman Catholic Church, Christianity continued to expand in Europe. Because even though there was the domination of Christianity in the former Roman world, there were still so-called barbarian peoples and tribes that lived in the lands that were beyond the former Roman Empire. And in many of these cases, there was a real effort to bring the gospel to them. Let me give you an example of this by sort of giving a quick timeline of early Christianity in Britain. And by Britain, I mean the British Islands, what today we would call England, Scotland, and Wales. Now, much of Britain was ruled as a Roman colony, and as Christianity expanded throughout the Roman Empire, it naturally came to Roman Britain. About the year 201, Origen of Alexandria said that Christianity had extended beyond Roman territory in Britain. In other words, places in Britain, he said, had not yet reached by the Romans, were subjected to Christ. So the Romans did not occupy or rule the entire island that today makes up Scotland, England, and Wales. But Christianity went even further beyond the Roman territories. And there's record of martyrs in England during the Diocletian persecution. That's the year 305. In the year 314, three British bishops were present at the Council of Aries, coming from York, London, and Lincoln. There were three British bishops present at the Council at Arinium in the year 358. And Athanasius counted the British Christians as those who were loyal to the faith in the year 363. Later, so did Chrysostom and Jerome. And when the Roman legions withdrew from Britain in the year 410, Christianity remained there. So Christianity goes back on the island of Great Britain for many, many centuries, at least by the early 3rd century. Now, Ninian, who died in the year 432, was the son of a converted chieftain of Cumbria. He went to Rome as a young man, where he was instructed in the faith and consecrated as a bishop. He returned home to work for the conversion of his own people. And then, of course, there's Pelagius. This was Augustine's great opponent. He came from Britain, and he was in Rome from about 383 to 410. Pelagius was condemned at Ephesus in 431 and the Council of Orange in 529. But again, we're just establishing that there was a long Christian presence on the islands of Great Britain. So when Pope Gregory the Great sent the Roman monk Augustine of Canterbury to bring Christianity to Britain in the year 597, he actually came to an island that already had a strong Christian presence. Even though this man, Augustine of Canterbury, was called the Apostle to the English, and he's considered to be one of the founders of the English Church, there was already a vibrant and organized Christian presence in England and in the British Isles long before him. Yet, there was very little Christian presence among and evangelization towards the Anglo-Saxons that had come into Britain and dominated the land since the Romans retreated in 410. Augustine of Canterbury was successful in converting King Ethelbert and thousands of the king's subjects. They had a massive baptism of hundreds or thousands on Christmas Day in the year 597. Now, all of this kind of works towards many different people and generations of evangelism in the Western Empire during this period. Another example of this is Patrick and the evangelization of the Irish. The man we know as Patrick was a Briton, and as a boy, he had been taken into slavery in Ireland. He displayed tremendous courage when he engineered an escape to France. There in France, he studied deeply, and he found his life's mission to go back to Ireland to evangelize the land where he had been a slave. Now, Patrick seemed to be the perfect man for Ireland. He had the courage to face his former slave master. It's said that when he met his former slave master, afterwards the slave master committed suicide because he was so troubled at seeing the young man that was once his slave. Patrick opposed the Druids, and he evangelized the royalty of the island. Patrick also established churches, founded religious communities, and he preached the gospel. By the year 444, he had founded the Cathedral Church of Armagh, which soon became the educational and administrative center of the Irish Church. Now, in the century after Patrick, an Irish nobleman named Columba vowed at the age of 32 to win for Christ as many pagans as Christians. as whose death he had caused in leading a battle where many men were killed. So driven by that strong missionary zeal, he set off with 12 disciples for Iona. That's off the southwest coast of Scotland, where he established a monastery. And this was the base for his work. But it also proved a place of great influence, not only in Christianizing Scotland and Britain, but also in evangelizing as far as Germany, France, Italy, and even Africa. Now, before we leave kind of this era of Christians, and Patrick specifically, I want to read to you a longer prayer from Patrick. There's an old prayer or hymn that's attributed to Patrick. It's called Patrick's Breastplate, in the sense that it was his prayer of protection. You know, we think of a breastplate being something that is protective. And this really beautiful prayer sort of gives us a flavor of just sort of everyday Christian thought and thinking and influence, and maybe a little bit more than everyday because Patrick was a remarkable man. But it was said that he prayed this prayer, singing it as a song when he was on his way to preach the gospel and an ambush was set against them. This prayer, or maybe we should say song, gives a good sense of his trust in God and what would be an expression of faith in that age. So this is the song or poem, prayer, whatever you want to call it, known as Patrick's Breastplate. I bind unto myself today the strong name of the Trinity, by invocation of the same, the three in one and one in three. I bind this day to me forever by power of faith, Christ's incarnation, his baptism in the Jordan River, his death on the cross for my salvation, his bursting from the spiced tomb, his riding up the heavenly way, his coming at the day of doom. I bind unto myself today. I bind unto myself the power of the great love of the cherubim, the sweet well done in judgment hour, the service of the seraphim, confessor's faith, apostle's word, the patriarch's prayers, the prophet's scrolls, all good deeds done unto the Lord, and purity of virgin souls. I bind unto myself today the virtues of the starlit heaven, the glorious sun's giving ray, the whiteness of the moon at even, the flashing of the lightning free, the whirling wind's tempestuous shocks, and stable earth, deep salt sea, around the old eternal rocks. I bind unto myself today the power of God to hold and lead, his eye to watch, his might to stay, his ear to hearken to my need, the wisdom of my God to teach, his hand to guide, his shield to ward, the word of God to give me speech, his heavenly host to be my guard. Against the demon's snares of sin, the vice that gives temptation force, the natural lusts that war within, the hostile men that mar my course, or few or many, far or nigh, in every place and in all hours, against their fierce hostility, I bind to me these holy powers. Against all Satan's spells and wiles, against false words of heresy, against the knowledge that defiles, against the heart's idolatry, against the wizard's evil craft, against the death wound and the burning, the choking wave and the poisoned shaft, protect me, Christ, till thy returning. Christ be with me, Christ within me, Christ behind me, Christ before me, Christ beside me, Christ to win me, Christ to comfort and restore me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ in quiet, Christ in danger, Christ in hearts of all that love me, Christ in mouth of friend and stranger. I bind unto myself the name, the strong name of the Trinity, by invocation of the same, the three in one and the one in three. of whom all nature hath creation, eternal Father, Spirit, Word, praise to the Lord of my salvation. Salvation is of Christ the Lord. Now you have to admit, that is a beautiful and powerful expression of faith, trust, reliance, devotion in the Lord. Don't fool yourself. These medieval Christians, many of them, even though in some ways their faith was marred by superstition and by strange things, many, many of them had a real relationship of faith and love with Jesus Christ. Now, one of the other great dynamics of this time of history is that there was oftentimes in many of these centuries, Christians had to live with the threat of invasion. This conglomeration of Celts, Goths, and the remnants of the Roman Empire eventually reshaped into what some people called the Holy Roman Empire. But they seemed to have very little missionary concern for the Vikings of Northern Europe. The Vikings invaded and dominated these Christianized Celts and Goths, ushering in the Western world into what some people called the Second Dark Age. Never before had such terror appeared in Britain, for example, as we have now suffered from a pagan race. That is what the English scholar Alcyon of 793 said about a raid on a monastery there in England. It was the first major event of the so-called Age of the Vikings. This is what Alcyon wrote. He said, "Behold the church of St. Colbert, splattered with the blood of the priests of God, despoiled of all of its ornaments, a place more venerable than all in Britain, is given as a prey to the pagan peoples." It's hard to really understand sometimes the terror that people lived under. Here's another quote from a contemporary account. "The Northmen cease not to slay and carry into captivity the Christian people, to destroy the churches and to burn the towns. Everywhere there's nothing but dead bodies, clergy and laymen, nobles and common people, women and children. There's no road or place where the ground is not covered with corpses. We live in distress and anguish before the spectacle of the destruction of the Christian people." There was an English prayer book at the time that included this prayer. This was the prayer: "From the fury of the Northmen, O Lord, deliver us." Now, as the Vikings invaded, they received the gospel from the people whom they terrorized. The Vikings were Christianized partially through this. Oftentimes, monks were taken and sold as slaves, and as much as they could, they evangelized. Christian girls were forced to become wives or mistresses, and they became unwilling, yet sometimes effective, missionaries. This period of time was bad for the Europeans, but in the big picture, it was good for the gospel. Though the Vikings might have been infamous for their attacks on Christian churches and monasteries, those very raids began a centuries-long process of Christian conversion. See, the Vikings raided because these cultures had things that they wanted, and they reasoned that they had not, or at least they didn't have as much as these places that they were invading, because their gods were not as powerful as the God of Christianity. Envy, ironically, played a very important role in introducing Christianity to these Viking peoples. All of this reminds us that even though God loves nations and he works through nations, God still puts a higher priority on his kingdom than he does on the nations of the world. God will allow nations to be afflicted if it will further the work of his kingdom. Now, I wish I could tell you that in these centuries, that the violence that happened was always happening upon Christians and never from Christians. But that's not the truth. There were also many forced conversions in this age. Let me kind of explain. Soon after the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine, though the first use of force was not designed to convert pagans, but it was used to correct Christians who were in error. Augustine, the great bishop of Hippo in North Africa, in the late 4th and early 5th century, was faced with a heretic sect, the Donatists. And Augustine wanted to bring them back into the Orthodox communion, and he agonized whether it was permissible to use coercion, torture, to do it. Eventually, Augustine decided that it was okay to use physical force, even torture, to bring heretics back into proper belief. I know that sounds amazing, but one biblical text that persuaded Augustine was in the parable of the great banquet. You'll find that in Luke chapter 14. I don't know if you remember that banquet. There was a rich man who gave a feast. And when no one that he invited showed up for the feast, he told his servants to go out and compel people to come in. Matter of fact, let me read you that verse from Luke chapter 14, verse 23. Then the master said to the servant, "Go out into the highways and hedges and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled." Friends, I got to say, it sounds strange to us, but that was actually the theological justification that Augustine used to force people to either renounce their heresy or to give up their unbelief and come into the Christian faith. I don't think that that's a valid use of that passage at all. I think Augustine was in error when he declared such a thing. And I think that that principle did a lot of damage for the cause of God's kingdom. The principle that it is acceptable, it is good, you might even say, to use force, physical force, against people to either correct them from error or bring them into the kingdom. Now, it wasn't later until the Frankish kingdom of Charlemagne in the 8th century that we see force being used to coerce conversions. Specifically, it was used in the campaign against the Saxons. And why did Charlemagne move in this direction? Why did he approve of this? Well, first of all, because of the concept of being a Christian king that had developed in the previous century, and it was understood that the duty of expanding Christendom was the responsibility of the Christian king. And if he had to use force to do it, then that was part of the king's duty. Again, very much based on an Old Testament kind of concept of what it is to be a king. Second, there were advisors at the very highest levels of Charlemagne's government who pushed this policy. Scholars like to think that one of the hardliners was a man named Lull, who himself was of Anglo-Saxon origin and had traveled with Boniface and had succeeded Boniface as the Bishop of Mainz. He had given his life to the conversion of the Saxons, and nothing worked in doing it. So in essence, he said to Charlemagne, "These stubborn people will never convert on their own. We've got to force them to submit." So that was a very sad and unfortunate effort. I don't think it was terribly widespread, but it was certainly present in European Christianity of this period, where populations would be forced to submit, as happened extensively in Islam in later centuries, or actually at that some of those current centuries. But many people saw the danger of such mass conversions. A man we've discussed before, Alcuin of York, England, wrote a letter in the year 796 suggesting that careful thought should be given to the best ways to teach and disciple people in the faith, and he thought that it was useless to baptize people who had no understanding of the faith or who were not personally persuaded to be Christians. New believers, he said, should not be taught, or should be taught, I should say, about the immortality of the soul, about heaven and hell, about the Trinity, about the saving mission of Jesus Christ, about his passion, his resurrection, his ascension, and his coming judgment of the world. So there were people pushing back against these ideas, but at the same time, they were present in this period. And I think it's a great tragedy, actually, is it not? That there were people who were compelled to have an insincere faith, compelled to be baptized, or they could be killed or sold as slaves. And they did it just because they were coerced to do it. No, we need a Christian faith that is not imposed by coercion, but rather is received freely by faith. Well, look, that's going to end it for this particular lecture. We'll continue on in our further lectures to discuss what God was doing in the world at this particular time. But as we reflect on what daily life was like for many Christians in this period of the Christian Empire, let's remember that in many ways, their Christian experience is somewhat like ours. They had to trust Jesus. We have to trust Jesus. They had to die to self and to the flesh. We have to die to self and to the flesh. We need to come together as believers and honor God and be instructed by his word, and they the same. There is a wonderful thread of continuity through the centuries of Christianity, even though there are also several differences between Christian expression through the generations and through the different places in the globe. But we learn this, we're grateful for it, and I hope you can join me for one of our next lectures as well.